are refunded 75% of the cost of their tickets. The passengers are left to fend for themselves. Adi and the Loafbeers consider staying in Casablanca, on the chance that the authorities might issue them Moroccan visas, but then think better of it. Casablanca has already seen its fair share of warfare, and Morocco, now under Vichy governance, is likely no safer an option than France. They have to move quickly. There are 600 refugees, most of whom are desperate for a way out. They need a plan, and they need one fast. After several days of gathering information from every possible source, expats, government officials, dock hands, journalists, they learn that there are ships sailing for Brazil from Spain. Spain and Portugal, according to the newspapers, are still neutral. Adi and the Loafbeers decide right away to travel north to the Iberian Peninsula, where the only boats headed for South America, they discover after further research, depart from Cadiz, a port in western Spain. To get there, however, will first require finding a way to Tangier, a city on the North African coast, 340 kilometers from Casablanca, and then crossing the Strait of Gibraltar, a narrow stretch of water funneling virtually all traffic into and out of the Mediterranean from the Atlantic, a stretch of water that had been bombed heavily the year before by the Vichy French Air Force, and which is now under strict surveillance and fortification by the British Navy. If they are able to cross the strait to Tarifa, they'll have to make their way north another 100 kilometers to Cadiz. It won't be easy. But from what they can tell, it's their only option. They pack quickly, and Adi goes about arranging transportation to Tangier. The port in Tangier is crowded with ships steaming across the strait, to and from Tarifa. Adi counts three British aircraft carriers, a handful of cargo ships, and dozens of fishing boats. He and the Loafbeers walk the piers, debating which vessel they should approach. There is a ticketing office at the far end of the port, but visas will surely be required to make a purchase. They decide they'll be better off hiring a captain on their own. How about him? Adi points to a fisherman with sun-cracked skin and a shaggy beard, sitting at the square stern of his boat, eating his lunch. His skiff is small with a flat bottom and peeling blue paint, just inconspicuous enough, Adi hopes, to cross the strait unnoticed, and just functional enough to bring them safely to Tarifa. A faded Spanish flag flaps gently from the craft's narrow bow. The fisherman shakes his head, however, at Madame Loafbeer's first offer. Peligroso, he says. Madame Loafbeer removes her watch. Esto también, she says, surprising Adi with her Spanish. The fisherman squints down the pier as if trying to decipher whether any of authority might be watching, and then looks back up at the threesome again for a moment, considering his options. Adi is grateful for their appearance. They may be refugees, but they are certainly put together well enough to look trustworthy. El reloj, the fisherman finally huffs. Madame Loafbeer slips the watch into her purse. Primero, Tarifa, she says coolly. The fisherman grunts and waves them aboard. Adi lowers himself into the skiff first, to help load their belongings. The Loafbeers, thankfully, had decided in Casablanca to ship their three massive portmanteaus to Madame Loafbeer's brother in Brazil. They travel now with leather valises similar in size to Adi's. When their things are stowed, Adi offers his hand as the women step gingerly into the boat, eyeing a small pool of oily water gathered on the floor of its stern. The ride is bumpy. Madame Loafbeer vomits twice over the side. Alishka's cheeks turn a ghostly shade of white. No one speaks. Adi holds his breath on multiple occasions when he's sure their small skiff is about to be engulfed in the wake of a passing freighter. He keeps his gaze fixed on Tarifa's rocky coastline, praying they can make their way unnoticed and afloat to Spanish soil.
June 22nd to 30th, 1941. In a surprise twist of events, Hitler turns his back on Stalin, breaking the German-Soviet non-aggression pact and attacking the entire Eastern Front, including Russian-occupied Poland. Huge in scope, the invasion is codenamed Operation Barbarossa. In Lvov, after a week of bitter fighting, the Soviets are defeated. Before retreating, however, the NKVD massacres thousands of Polish, Jewish, and Ukrainian intellectuals, political activists, and criminals held in the city's prisons. The Germans publicly blamed the Jews for these massacres, declaring that the victims were mainly Ukrainian. This, of course, enrages the pro-German Ukrainian militia, who, along with the Einsatzgruppen, SS death squads, take vigilante action against the Jews inhabiting the city. Jewish men and women who haven't found their way into hiding are stripped, beaten, and murdered in the streets by the thousands.
Chapter 21. Jakob and Bella. Lvov, Soviet-occupied Poland, July 1, 1941. Lvov has come undone. The madness began at the end of June, shortly after Hitler's surprise attack on the Soviet Union, which is when Jakob, Bella, Halina, and Franka went into hiding. They'd been holed up in their building's basement for over a week. A Polish friend named Piotr brings news and food when he can, a one-man makeshift relief organization. The city is swarming with Einsatzgruppen, and what appears to be a Ukrainian militia, Piotr said when he first came by to check on them. They are targeting Jews. When Jacob asked why, Piotr explained that the NKVD had murdered the majority of the inmates at the city's jails before fleeing, thousands of whom were Ukrainian, and that the Jews were being blamed. It doesn't make much sense, he said. Hundreds of the inmates were Jewish. But this doesn't seem to matter. There is a single knock from upstairs. Piotr. It was no secret that he, too, would be targeted by the Germans should he be discovered aiding Jews. Jakob stands. I'll go, he offers, lighting a candle and tiptoeing to the staircase. Along with news of the pogrom, Piotr often brings food, small parcels of bread and cheese. His knocks usually come once a day in the evening. Be careful, Bella whispers. Yesterday, 10 days after the pogrom began, Piotr said that the paper estimated the city's Jewish death toll at a horrific 3,500. 10, 20, even 100, Bella could believe. But thousands? The statistic is far too gruesome for her to bear, and she can't put out of her mind the fact that she hasn't heard from her sister since the invasion. Again and again, she imagines Anna's beautiful body among those strewn in the streets. Piotr says he has to step over corpses just to reach their doorstep. Bella has begged Piotr to visit Anna's flat. He's been twice, and twice he's returned with the news that his knocks have gone unanswered. She listens as Jakob climbs the stairs. Soon, there is another single knock, this one from Jakob, followed by 4 quick reciprocal taps, Piotr's code indicating it is safe to open the door. The hinges whine, and a story below, Bella exhales, listening to the faint murmur of conversation. It's going to be all right, Alina says, sitting down next to her. Bella nods, admiring her sister-in-law's strength. Adam is missing, too. He'd insisted on remaining above ground during the pogrom, claiming that the resistance needed him now more than ever. Halina has yet to hear from him, and yet here she is offering Bella comfort. The women sit quietly, listening. After a while, the conversation halts and Bella stiffens. The silence overhead stretches on for 2, 3, 4 seconds, then nearly half a minute. Something's wrong, she whispers. She can feel it in the dread blooming within her ribcage. Whatever it is, she doesn't want to know. Finally, the door above squeals, the deadbolt snaps shut, and footsteps make their way slowly back to the staircase. By the time Jakob reaches the basement, Bella can barely breathe. Jakob hands the candle and a loaf of bread to Halina and lowers himself to sit. Bella, he says softly. Bella looks up, shakes her head. Please, no. But in Jakob's face, she can see that her instinct is right.
Oh, God, no.
Jakob swallows, staring at the ground for a moment before uncurling his fingers. In his palm is a note. Piotr found it, sticking out from under Anna's door. Bella, I'm so sorry. Bella stares at the wrinkled slip of paper, as if it were a bomb about to detonate. She presses her lower back into the wall behind her, brushing Jakob's hand away when he reaches for her. Jakob and Helena exchange a worried glance, but Bella doesn't notice. She is paralyzed by the notion that whatever her husband has, whatever he knows, will destroy her. That in a moment's time, everything will change. Jakob waits patiently, silently, until finally Bella gathers the courage to take the note. Holding the wrinkled paper with both hands, she recognizes her sister's handwriting immediately. They are taking us away. I think they are going to kill us. Bella braces herself, suddenly unsteady, as if the ground beneath her has given way. She crumples the note, and as the walls begin to spin, her world goes dark. She brings her fist to her forehead and wails. Chapter 22. Halina, Lvov, German-occupied Poland, July 18, 1941. Ready? Wolf asks. They've paused on a street corner, a block from the work camp. Halina nods, surveying the camp, a shoddy cement structure confined by a barbed wire top fence. At the entrance, a guard with a German shepherd at his heels. If things don't go as planned, she realizes, she'll spend the foreseeable future staring at that fence from the inside. But what other choices does she have? She can't sit idle any longer. It will destroy her. And perhaps Adam too, if it hasn't destroyed him already. You'd better go, Wolf says, before they think we're up to something. Halina glances down the street at the tables in front of a cafe two blocks east of them, their designated meeting place. Right, Halina says. She takes a breath and straightens her posture. Are you sure you want to do this alone? Wolf shakes his head, as if willing her to say no. Halina turns her attention again to the camp. Yes, I'm sure. Wolf, an acquaintance of Adam's from the underground, had insisted on walking with her to the camp from the city center, but Halina was adamant that he hang back once they arrived. At least that way, she reasoned, if her plan failed, he would be able to return to Lvov, recruit some help. Wolf nods. A Polish couple walks by, arm in arm. He waits for them to pass, then leans in as if to kiss Halina on the cheek. Good luck, he whispers, before righting himself and turning toward the cafe. Halina swallows. This is madness. She should be en route to Radom, she thinks, the summer's heat suddenly stifling in her lungs. Her father has sent a truck. There are rumors of another pogrom in Lvov, Saul wrote after hearing of the first one. Come to Radom. You will be better off here with us. Jakob, Bella, and Franka had left that morning. Halina had stayed. She'd been home 7 weeks ago in early June. She'd brought IDs along with some zlotys she'd saved. Not that either would do her parents and Mila any good in the ghetto. The black market had all but dried up, and there was no use for an Aryan ID inside Wawowa's walls. Halina had thought about staying in Radom, but her job at the hospital provided some income. She'd have been foolish to leave it. And Adam was far too entrenched in Lvov's underground efforts for him to move back. And anyway, there wasn't room for the two of them in the tiny flat in the ghetto. She'd stayed only briefly, returning to Lvov with travel documents approved by her supervisor at the hospital, and with a set of her grandmother's silver, carefully wrapped in a napkin. Take it, Nehuma had insisted before she left. Maybe you can use it to help get us out of here. And then Hitler broke his pact with Stalin and unleashed his Einsatzgruppen in Lvov. A massacre ensued, and her father sent the truck to retrieve his family. It had pained her, turning down his plea to return home, and she hates to think about what the truck had cost. She knows the family needs her, but she can't leave Lvov without Adam, and Adam is missing. Halina recalls the day, just over 2 weeks ago, when the fighting let up in Lvov and it was finally safe to come out of hiding. She'd run the half kilometer to her old apartment, only to discover it empty. Adam was gone. He'd left in a hurry, it seemed, had taken his suitcase, some clothes, and his false ID from behind the watercolor painting in the kitchen. Halina had searched the apartment for a note, a hint, anything that might reveal where he'd gone, but had found nothing. Over the next 3 days, she visited each of the spots they designated as safe places to meet in an emergency, a dozen times. The arched doorway beneath the steps leading up to St. George's Cathedral, the stone fountain in front of the university, the back bar of the Scottish Cafe. But Adam was nowhere to be found. It wasn't until Wolf knocked on her door that Halina was able to piece together what had happened. Apparently, Wolf said, the Germans had shown up at Adam's flat one night during the pogrom. He had been taken to a work camp just outside Lvov city center. Wolf knew this only because someone in the underground had managed to bribe a guard in the camp to pass notes through the fence surrounding the property. Adam's note had shown up in Wolf's hands the week before. "Please check on my wife," it read. He'd signed the note with the name he and Halina used on their false papers, Brzoza. The underground had been trying to find a way to get him out, but without any luck. Hearing this news was an enormous relief. Adam was alive at least, but it also made Halina sick, not knowing what the Germans had in store for him. If they knew about his involvement in the underground, he was a dead man. "I have some silver," she told Wolf, "a set of cutlery." Wolf had nodded tentatively. "That could work," he said. "It's worth a try." Halina wraps her fingers around the leather handles of the purse hanging over her shoulder. "You'll get only one shot at this," she reminds herself. "Don't botch it." Her heart beats in double time as she makes her way toward the guard at the camp's entrance, feeling as if she's about to go on stage to perform in front of an unforgiving audience. The German shepherd notices her first and barks, straining against his leash, the tan and black fur over his shoulders spiked and angry. Halina doesn't flinch. She keeps her chin high, trying her best to exude a sense of purpose in her stride. With a leash wrapped firmly around his wrist, the guard stands with his feet spread wide for balance. By the time Halina reaches him, the German shepherd is nearly hysterical. Halina offers the guard a tight smile and then waits for the dog to quiet. When the barking ceases, she rifles through her purse for her ID. "My name is Halina Brzoza," she says in German. Like Russian, German had come easily to her. She'd perfected it when the Nazis first invaded Radom. She rarely speaks it, but to her surprise, the words flow naturally off of her tongue. The guard doesn't speak. "I'm afraid you have mistaken my husband for a Jew," Halina continues, handing the guard her forged ID. "He is inside, and I'm here to collect him." She hugs her purse to her side, feeling the lump of the cutlery against her ribs. The last time she'd used these knives and forks was around her parents' dining table. She'd have laughed then if someone had told her that someday they might be worth her husband's life. She eyes the guard as he examines her ID. Unlike some of the Germans in town, whose necks appear as broad as their skulls, this one is built tall and narrow. Shadows pool in his eye sockets and beneath his cheekbones. Halina wonders if his features have always been this sharp, or if he is as hungry as she, as the rest of Europe. "And why would I believe you?" the guard finally asks, handing her back her ID. Sweat has begun to gather on Halina's upper lip. She thinks quickly. "Please," she huffs, shaking her head as if the guard has offended her. "Do I look Jewish?" She stares hard at him, her green eyes unblinking praying that her assertiveness, which she has grown to rely upon, might help her. "Clearly there's been a mistake," she says. "And anyway, what would a Jew be doing with silver of this quality?" She slips the silver from her purse and unwraps a corner of the napkin to reveal the handle of a spoon. It glints under the sun. "It's my husband's great-great-grandmother's, who was German, by the way," Halina adds. "She was a Berghorst." She runs her thumb over the engraved B, silently thanking her mother for insisting she take it when she left Radom, and sending up an apology to her deceased grandmother, who grew up a proud Baumlit. The guard blinks at the sight of the silver. He looks around, making sure no onlookers have seen what he's seen. Returning his gaze to Halina, he lowers his chin, his silt-gray eyes again meeting hers. "Listen to me," he says. His voice has fallen almost to a whisper. "I don't know who you are, and frankly I don't care if your husband is a Jew or not, but if you say your husband is of German descent..." He pauses, looking down at the silver in Halina's hands. "I'm certain that the boss can help you out." "Then take me to him," Halina says without hesitation. The guard shakes his head. "No visitors. Give me what you have there and I'll bring it to him." "No offense, Herr..." The German hesitates. "Richter. Herr Richter. But I'm not parting with this until you've delivered me my husband." She slips the silver back into her purse, tucks it tightly into the crux of her elbow. Inwardly, she is trembling, but she keeps her knees locked in place and her expression steady. The guard narrows his eyes, then blinks. It seems he's not used to being told what to do, at least not by a civilian. "You'll have my head," Richter says coolly. "Then keep your head, and keep the silver, for yourself," Halina counters. "You look like you could use it." She holds her breath, wondering if she's gone too far. She hadn't meant the last bit as an insult, but it had sounded like one. Victor considers her for a moment. "His name," he finally says. Halina feels her shoulders relax a touch. "Brzoza. Adam Brzoza. Round spectacles, pale skin. He's the one in there who looks nothing like a Jew." Victor nods. "I make no promises," he says, "but come back in 1 hour. Bring your silver." Halina nods. "All right, then." She turns, walking briskly away from the camp. At the cafe, she finds Wolf seated at an outdoor table, a cup of chicory coffee before him, feigning interest in a newspaper. By the time she's seated across from him, Richter has disappeared from his post. "Can you spare an hour?" Halina asks, gripping the seat of her chair to steady her hands, grateful for the fact that the tables around them are empty. "Of course," Wolf says, and then lowers his voice. "What happened? I couldn't see a thing." Halina closes her eyes for a moment and exhales, willing her pulse to slow. When she looks up, she sees that Wolf has gone pale, that he is as nervous as she. "I offered him the silver," she says. "He tried to take it right then, but I told him he could have it as soon as he delivered me my husband." "Did he seem like he would come through?" "It's hard to tell." Wolf shakes his head. "Adam always said you had guts." Halina swallows, suddenly exhausted. "It's all an act. Let's just hope he believed it." As Wolf motions for the waitress, Halina contemplates how the war until recently has in many ways felt surreal. For a while, her family got by. Soon enough, she often told herself, life would return to normal. She would be fine. Her family would be fine. Her parents had endured the Great War and made it through. In time, they tossed the horrible hand of cards they'd been dealt back into the pile and start anew. But then things started to fall apart. First it was Selim, then Genek and Herta, gone, vanished. Then it was Bella's sister, Anna, and now Adam. All around her, it seems, Jews were disappearing. And suddenly, the consequences of this war were undeniably real. An understanding that sent Halina spiraling as she wrestled with the knowledge she both feared and loathed. She was powerless. Since then, she's begun to imagine the worst, picturing Salim and Genek and Herta locked up in Soviet prisons, starving to death, and drumming up a long list of the atrocities Adam had no doubt been subjected to at the work camp, telling herself that if he, of all people, with his looks and ID, had not been able to talk himself out of captivity by now, then it must be dire. And what of Adi? They haven't heard from him since the family moved into the ghetto nearly 2 years ago. Had he joined the army as he said he would? France has capitulated. Did the French army even exist anymore? She racks her memory often for the sound of Addie's voice, but quits when she finds she can't retrieve it. She hopes against hope that wherever he, Genek, Herta, and Salim are, they are safe, that they can sense how much the family misses them. A waitress brings a second mug of coffee and sets it on a saucer before Halina. She nods in thanks and glances at her watch, discouraged to find that only 5 minutes have passed. It's going to be a long hour, she realizes, removing the watch and setting it under the lip of her saucer so she can check the time more discreetly. And then she waits. Chapter 23. Genek and Herta. Altınay, Siberia, July 19, 1941. Herta drags the limb of a small pine toward a clearing in the forest. Yusef, 4 months old, is tied snug to her breast with a bedsheet. She steps carefully, scouring the ground for sleeping vipers and half-buried scorpions, humming to distract herself from the rumble in her stomach. It'll be hours before she receives her slice of bread and, if she's lucky, a tiny slab of dried fish. Yusef squirms and Herta lowers the log to the ground, running the cotton of her sweat-stained shirt sleeve across her forehead and squints up at the sky. The sun is directly overhead. Z, as they've taken to calling the baby, must be hungry. She finds a shady spot beneath a tall larch at the edge of the clearing and lowers herself carefully to sit cross-legged. From her perch, she can see Genek and a handful of others, 50 or so meters away, piling logs by the river. Their figures appear blurry in the July heat, as if they've begun to melt. Herta extracts Yusef carefully from his bedsheet harness and lays him gently to face her in the space between her legs, propping his head on her ankles. Wearing nothing but a cloth diaper, his skin, like hers, is pink and sticky to the touch. "Hot, aren't you, my love?" she says softly, wishing the sweltering temperatures would break, but knowing it will be another month at least before they do, and that the heat of summer, despite its intensity, is far more tolerable than the cold that will envelop them come October. Yusef looks up with his father's sky-blue eyes, staring at her in the only way he knows how, without blinking or judgment, and for a moment, Herta can do nothing but smile. Unbuttoning her blouse, she follows his gaze as he studies the branches of the larch above. "Any birds up there?" she asks, smiling. Though Genek will never admit it, he refers to Altınay as an endless swath of Siberian shitscape. The forest, despite the suffocating heat and hellish circumstances, is undeniably beautiful. Here, seemingly as far removed from civilization as possible, surrounded by pine, spruce, and larch, every shade of green she can imagine, and by big open skies and blackwater rivers that snake their way through the trees on the journey north, Herta is but a fleck against nature's backdrop. She feels at peace. She closes her eyes as Yusef nurses, taking in the soft breeze, the chatter of swallows and wagtails in the branches above, feeling grateful for the blessing of the healthy child at her breast. Yusef was born just before midnight on the 17th of March, on the frozen dirt floor of the barracks. Herta had heaved logs on the day he arrived, breathing through contractions as they came and went every 10 then 7, then 5 minutes, before finally asking her friend Yulia to find Genek, unsure if she could make her way back to camp on her own. "When you count 3 minutes between contractions," Dr. Dembowski had said, "then you know the baby is coming." Yulia had returned alone, explaining that Genek had been sent to the town on an errand, and that her husband Otto would cover for him as soon as he returned. Yulia had helped Herta to her feet and walked with her, slowly, arm in arm, back to camp, where she called for Dembowski. When Genek arrived 2 hours later, Herta was barely recognizable. Despite the Arctic cold, she was drenched in sweat, her eyes pressed shut as she lay in a fetal tuck, drawing and exhaling breath in quick, heavy bouts through O-shaped lips, as if trying to extinguish a stubborn flame. Clumps of wet, dark hair stuck to her forehead. Yulia sat by her side, massaging her back between contractions. "You made it," Herta breathed when she rolled over to see Genek, wrapping her hands around his and squeezing hard. Yulia wished them luck and left, and Herta endured another 6 hours of pelvis-splitting pain before it was time finally, mercifully, to push. It was 1:45 when, with Genek at Herta's side and Dembowski crouched between her knees, Yosef took his first breath. At the sound of their baby's cry, and at Dembowski's definitive "toch wopiec," "it's a boy," Herta and Genek beamed at each other with wet, exhausted eyes. That night, they tucked Yosef between them in their straw bed, swaddled in Herta's wool scarf, and bundled with two of Genek's extra shirts and a small knit hat that was passed down between the babies born at the camp. All they could see of him were his eyes, which he rarely opened, and the pink of his lips. They worried about whether he was warm enough, or whether they'd roll over onto him in the night. But soon a deep fatigue overcame them, blotting out their fears like blizzard clouds over the sun. And after a few minutes, all three Kurtzes were sound asleep. Within days, Yosef began to put on weight. Herta went back to work, and she and Genek grew used to sleeping with a lump between them. The only real trouble came in the mornings, when Yosef would wake wailing, his eyes frozen shut. Herta learned to rub warm droplets of breast milk onto his lids to coax them open. Now, Herta marvels, it's hard for her to believe it's been 4 months since her son was born. She had marked the passage of time by his first smile, his first tooth, by the day he was able to roll himself over from his belly to his back. What will it be next, she wonders. Will he suck his thumb? Start to crawl? Say his first words? Herta has written home at each milestone, aching for news of her family in Bielsko. She hasn't heard from them, though, since before she and Genek left Lvov. The last letter she received had been from her brother Zygmunt. His news was disheartening. "There are fewer and fewer Jews left in Bielsko," he wrote. Some apparently had left at the start of the war to join the Polish army. Others had been shipped off by train and never returned. "I've pleaded with the family," Zygmunt wrote, "beg them to leave or to hide, but Lola is far too pregnant to travel safely." By now, Herta realizes her sister's baby would be almost a year old. "And our parents," Zygmunt added, "are too stubborn to leave. I suggested we might come to you in Lvov, but they refused." Herta thinks about the child she has yet to meet, wondering if she's an aunt to a boy or a girl, if the day would come that Z would get to know his cousin. At the moment, it seems unfathomable, separated by such a vast stretch of land, with the world crumbling around them. Herta prays often for her family. As much as she is able to somehow make the most of her time here in Altenai, there is nothing she wants more than to return to a life of freedom. Part of her wishes she could travel forward in time and skip to the end of the war. But there is also part of her that prays for time to stop, for there is no telling what the future might bring. What if, at war's end, she returns to Poland to discover her family is no longer there? The idea is impossible to contemplate. It's like staring directly at the sun. She can't do it. She won't. And so instead, she puts it out of her mind, finding solace in the fact that for now, at least at this very moment, she and Genek are healthy, and their son is perfect. At dusk, Herta finds Genek in their barracks, smiling. Some good news? She asks. She unties Yusef from her chest, lays the sheet on the dirt floor, and sets him on it. Standing, she rests a hand on her husband's cheek, realizing how lovely it is to see his dimples. Genek's eyes are bright. I think the tides have finally turned, he says. Herta, the Soviets may soon be on our side. A month ago, they learned that Hitler had broken his pact with Stalin and invaded the Soviet Union. The news had apparently stunned the world, but it had done nothing to change the situation in Altenay. Herta tilts her head at this news. We thought so at the start of the war too, yes? True, but this afternoon, Otto and I heard the guards whispering something about moving prisoners south to form an army.
An army?
Darling, I think Stalin is going to grant us amnesty.
Amnesty?
Herta marvels at the word. A pardon. But for what? For being Polish? It's a difficult concept to digest. But if it means they will be freed, Herta decides, then by all means she will welcome an amnesty. Where would we go? She wonders aloud. From what they've heard, there isn't a Poland to return to. Perhaps Stalin is thinking of sending us off to fight. Herta looks at her husband, at his gaunt figure, his newly receding hairline, the hollow over his collarbone. He's still handsome despite it all, but they both know he isn't in any shape to fight. She thinks of the others in the camp, too, most of whom are either sick or starving or both. Aside from Otto, born with the natural build of a heavyweight boxer, none of the prisoners are fit to go to battle. She opens her mouth to voice the concern, but, seeing the hope in Genek's eyes, she swallows the thought, kneeling instead by Yusef, who is busy practicing his new trick of rolling onto his stomach. Herta tries to picture it. Genek, suited up alongside the Soviets, fighting for Stalin, for the man who'd put them in exile, condemned them to a life of labor. It seems backward. She wonders what this would mean for her and Yusef. What would become of them if Genek is sent off to battle? Do you have a sense of when this amnesty might be granted? She asks, rolling Yusef gently to his back. Yusef flaps his arms happily, showing off two miniature replicas of his father's dimples. No, Genek says, lowering himself to sit beside her. He squeezes Yusef's knee, and Yusef coos, smitten. Genek smiles. But soon, I think. Soon. Chapter 24. Addy. Ilha das Flores, Brazil, late July 1941. It's become Addy's habit to wake early, well before the other detainees are up, and walk the path circumventing the tiny Ilha das Flores. He needs the exercise, and even more so, the chance to be alone for an hour. Together, they help preserve his sanity. The scenery helps too. Guanabara Bay is beautiful at dawn, when it is at its calmest, a mirror image of the sky. By 10 in the morning, it's teeming with boat traffic heading to and from Rio de Janeiro's busy port. This morning, Addy awoke before sunup to the shrill cavatina of a kingfisher perched on his windowsill. He was tempted to slip back into sleep, for in his dream he was home in Radom, and his family was just as he'd left them. His father sat at the dining room table reading the weekend edition of Radomir Levin, his mother opposite, humming as she sewed a leather patch onto the elbow of a sweater. In the living room, Genek and Jakob played a game of cards. Felicia toddled about gripping a rag doll by the ankles, and Mila and Halina shared the bench at the baby grand, taking turns at the keys. Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata spread out on the music rack before them.
The only person missing from the dream was him. He didn't mind, though. He could have watched the scene for hours, content just to hover above it, basking in its warmth, in the simple knowledge that all was well. But the kingfisher was persistent, and eventually Addie's dream faded, and he rose, sighing as he rubbed the sleep from his eyes, dressed, and set off for his walk. On the trail, he plucks flowers, each with a name that has become familiar to him over the past 3 weeks. Amaryllis, hibiscus, azalea, and his favorite, the bird of paradise, which, with its fan-like crown of foliage and technicolor red and blue petals, resembles a bird in flight. There is one species of lily on the island to which he seems to be allergic. When he stumbles upon it, he sneezes for the next 15 minutes into his mother's handkerchief, which he carries with him always, like a talisman. Back at the cafeteria, Addie props his bouquet into a water glass, setting it at the table where he and the Loofbeers typically meet for breakfast. A staff worker appears, and Addie greets him with a smile, "E la bom dia, tudo bem?" The first Portuguese words he'd learned upon arrival.
"Sto bem, si, senhor,"
the staffer offers, handing Addie a cup of yerba mate tea. Addie carries his tea to the porch, where he turns his chair to face west, toward Rio's coastline. Since the ship arrived in South America, the bitter taste of yerba has grown on him. As he brings the cup to his lips, he takes in the peaceful morning, the smell of the tropics, the ubiquitous birdsong. Under normal circumstances, he might close his eyes and bask in the beauty of it all. But the circumstances, of course, are nowhere near normal. There is far too much at stake for him to truly unwind. And so instead, he stares at the coastline, reflecting on the past several months, on what had been required of him to get to this island off the coast of Brazil. As it turns out, the fisherman he'd chosen in Tangier was able, despite his shoddy skiff, to deliver Addie and the Loofbeers safely to Tarifa. From there, they rode north by bus to the port in Cadiz, where they were told a Spanish ship, called the Cabo de Hornos, would depart in a week for Rio. "I'll sell you tickets," the agent in Cadiz said, "but I cannot guarantee they will let you off the boat with expired visas." This was not what they wanted to hear, but as far as they knew, the Hornos was their only hope. A speculation that was confirmed when they began recognizing the faces of other Alsina passengers at the port. Passengers who had also been lucky enough to make their way across the strait to Cadiz. Addie and the Loofbeers didn't waste time in purchasing one-way tickets aboard the Hornos, assuring themselves that if they made it as far as South America, they would not be turned away. When they finally boarded the ship, Addie was forced to acknowledge that he had but a handful of francs left to his name. He would be starting over in Brazil with next to nothing, a truth he grappled with as the Hornos steamed southwest toward Rio. The trip took 10 days. None of the refugees on board slept much, as they had been warned when they embarked that at least half a dozen ships before them had been sent back to Spain, the thought of which prompted some to threaten suicide.
"I'll jump, I swear it," one Spaniard told Addie. "I'll kill myself before I let Franco do the deed."
Addie, Alishka, and Madame Loofbeer clung to their expired visas and to the steadfast hope that the captain of the Alsina had been able to send a wire, as he'd promised, to the Brazilian embassy in Vichy. Perhaps if the petition had reached Souza Dantas, the ambassador would help. Even if it hadn't, there was always the chance that Brazil's president, Getúlio Vargas, would understand their circumstances and extend their papers upon arrival. It wasn't their fault, after all, that the journey had taken so long. It was the 17th of July when the Cabo de Hornos finally docked in Rio and, by some stroke of luck, her passengers were allowed to disembark. Addie was overjoyed. The freedom was short-lived, however. 3 days later, Addie, the Loofbeers, and the 37 other Alsina passengers who'd arrived on the Hornos with expired visas were greeted at their doorsteps by Brazilian police and escorted back to the port, where they were loaded onto a freight boat and shipped 7 kilometers offshore to Ilha das Flores, where they were now detained.
"We're being held hostage," Madame Lovebier seethed after their first day on the island. "C'est absurde."
They were given no explanation for why they were being held. They could only assume it was due to their expired visas, a hunch that was verified when one of the passengers, fluent in Portuguese, caught a glimpse of a written notice indicating Vargas's intent to send the refugees back to Spain. Addy takes another sip of tea. He refuses to believe that after 6 months, he'll end up where he began, in war-torn Europe. The Alsina passengers have come this far. Someone will surely persuade the president to let them stay. Alishka's uncle, perhaps. He'd hosted them those first few days in Rio. He seemed like a good person. He had money. But then again, what access did a civilian have to the president? They will need someone with influence. As Madame Lovebier often says, when the right palms are greased, we'll get our visas. The Lovebiers have the means to offer a bribe, but to whom those right palms belong, Addy has no clue. He is certain that with no contacts in Brazil, no grasp of the language, and no savings, he will be of little help. He's done everything he can to get them this far. The rest, as hard as it is to admit, is beyond his control. According to the Lovebiers, their hope at the moment lies with Hagenauer, an Alsina passenger whose grandfather in Rio has a tenuous connection to Brazil's Minister of Foreign Relations. A week ago, Hagenauer had bribed a guard on the island to pass along a letter to his grandfather explaining the circumstances, in hopes that his grandfather would then deliver a plea to the minister on the hostage's behalf. The plan, everyone agreed, seemed promising. Until it came to fruition, though, there was nothing to do but wait. Addy finishes his tea and cradles the ceramic cup in his palms, his mind drifting to Alishka, to the spot at the base of his neck she'd kissed the night before, as she excused herself to get her beauty rest. They'd decided in Dakar that they were destined to marry, an idea Madame Lovebier resented vehemently. But Addy isn't fazed by her disapproval. In time, he assures himself, he'll convince la grande dame he's worthy of her daughter's hand. He watches a barge make its way to Rio's port, wondering, as he often does, what his family would think of Alishka. She is smart, and she is Jewish. She's passionate and well-spoken, capable of a good debate. Surely his siblings would think highly of her. His father, too. But would his mother? He can hear Nahuma sometimes, telling him he's in over his head, warning that Alishka is too spoiled to be the kind of wife Addy deserves. She is spoiled, he can admit, but he knows that this isn't the real reason his mother would object. Relationships begin with honesty, Nahuma once told him. This is the foundation, for to be in love means to be able to share everything, your dreams, your faults, your deepest fears. Without these truths, a relationship will collapse. Addy has spent hours contemplating his mother's words, ashamed to admit that for all of his and Alishka's talk of Prague and Vienna and Paris, those glamorous snapshots of their lives before the war, he still cannot speak freely with her about his family. Nearly 2 years have passed since he last heard from his parents and siblings. 2 years. On the outside, he maintains his characteristic cheerfulness, but inside, the uncertainty is tearing him apart. He is unraveling. Alishka, on the other hand, is bright and sharp and seems so sure of her future. Addy knows instinctively that she would not be able to understand why at night he dreams of Radom and not Rio, why often he wishes he could wake up at home in his old room on Warszawska Street, despite the circumstances. He runs a thumb along the rim of his cup. Alishka has suffered losses too, he knows. Her father leaving when she was young was hard for her, and perhaps because of this,
She's convinced herself it's useless to live in the past. Eliska's world, Addie has begun to realize, does not allow for retrospection, for grief.
You don't need to choose between Radom and Rio, Addie reminds himself. Not at the moment, at least. You are here now, on a nearly deserted island in South America, with a woman you love. Addie closes his eyes, trying for a moment to imagine a life without Eliska. A life with nothing connecting him to their shared European roots. A life without her smile, her touch, her unwavering ability to find joy in looking ahead rather than back. But he can't.
Chapter 25. Jakob and Bella. Outside Radom, German-occupied Poland, late July 1941. Jakob and Bella crouch behind a wall of supplies in the back of the delivery truck, their knees pulled to their chests, leaning into one another for support. Franka, her parents Moisha and Terza, and her brother Salik are hidden along the opposite wall. Up front, the driver curses, brakes whine as they begin to slow. Since leaving Lvov, they've stopped only twice for fuel. Otherwise, per Saul's instructions, they've barreled northwest toward Radom. The truck is crawling now. Through the walls there are voices. Germans.
Anhalten! Stop the vehicle!
Don't stop, Jakob whispers aloud. Please, don't stop.
What will happen if they are discovered? They are carrying their false papers, but it's obvious they are being transported illegally. Why else would they be hidden? Beside Jakob, Bella is silent, unflinching. It's as if, since losing Anna, she has become impervious to fear. Jakob has never seen her so inconsolable. He would do anything to help her, if she would just talk to him. But he can see it in her eyes. It's still too painful, too raw. She needs time. He wraps an arm around her, holding her close as the truck rolls to a stop, weaving a plea together in his mind. He will offer the Germans his camera, he decides, if they will let them continue on. But just as quickly as the truck had stopped, it lurches, engine roaring. They swerve hard, and for a moment, it feels as if they are balanced on two wheels. Succumbing to gravity, boxes begin to topple. Outside, German voices swell, angry, threatening. As the truck picks up speed, a volley of shots is fired, and a bullet rifts through the wooden walls inches above Jakob's head, leaving two small holes in its path. Amid the chaos, he and Bella bend their bodies between their knees. Jakob cradles the back of his head with one hand, Bella's with the other, praying as the engine growls and pops in its exertion. Faster! Drive faster! The crack of gunfire chases them long after the shouting has dissipated. At first, Bella had opposed the idea of returning to Radom, clinging to the hope that Anna might still be alive. I have to find my sister, she'd snapped, surprising Jakob with the anger in her tone. When it was safe enough to come out of hiding, they discovered that the Germans had set up detention camps around Lvov, where anyone suspicious was imprisoned indefinitely. Bella had become fixated on visiting these camps, on the chance that her sister might be confined to one of them. Jakob didn't like the idea of her going anywhere near a German detention camp, but he knew better than to object. And so for a week, Bella made the rounds, risking confinement herself. In the end, she found no record of Anna, nor of her husband Daniel. It was through a neighbor that Bella finally learned what exactly had happened. Anna and Daniel had been in hiding as well, along with Daniel's brother Simon, when the Germans first invaded Lvov. On the second night of the pogrom, a group of Wehrmacht soldiers broke into their apartment with a warrant to arrest Simon, calling him an activist. Simon wasn't there. He'd ventured out to find some food.
Then we take you, the soldiers had said, grabbing Daniel by the arm.
He had had no choice but to leave, and Anna insisted she go with him. The neighbors said that there were dozens of others taken as well, that a friend of hers lived on a farm nearby and had seen them being funneled from a caravan of trucks to the edge of a forest, had heard the shots detonating like fireworks late into the night. Reluctantly, painfully, Bella gave up her search, agreeing finally to accept Saul's offer to send a truck. Since then, she's barely spoken. The truck decelerates slightly, and Jakob lifts his head. Please, not again. He listens for shots, for shouting, but all he can hear is the rumble of the truck's diesel engine. He closes his eyes, praying they are in the clear, praying that life in the ghetto will be better than the one they've left behind in Lvov. It's hard to imagine it could be any worse. They would be near family, at least. What's left of it? Beside him, Bella wonders whether they will make it back to Radom alive. If they do, she'll have to face her parents. Henry and Gustava have been assigned to Radom's smaller Glinica ghetto, several kilometers outside the city. She'll have to tell them what has happened to their youngest daughter. It's been nearly 3 weeks since Anna disappeared. Bella closes her eyes, feeling the familiar pain in her chest, deep and hollow, as if a piece of her is missing. Anna. For as long as she can remember, Bella has imagined her children growing up alongside Anna's, a fantasy that had felt almost attainable when, just before the pogrom, Anna had hinted that she and Daniel had exciting news to share. Briefly, Bella had pushed the war out of her mind and let the dream of children, of cousins being raised side by side, take over. Now, her sister will never have children, or know hers. Fresh tears run along the curve of Bella's jaw as she swallows this cold, incomprehensible truth.
July 25th to 29th, 1941. A second pogrom engulfs Lvov. Allegedly organized by Ukrainian nationalists and encouraged by the Germans, this pogrom, known as Petlura Days, targets Jews accused of collaborating with the Soviets. An estimated 2,000 Jews are murdered.
Chapter 26. Adi. Ilha das Flores, Brazil, August 12, 1941.
What kind of ship is it? Eliska asks.
Adi had spotted the small gray craft that morning on his walk around the island. As soon as Eliska woke, he'd brought her to the dock where it was moored to see for herself.
Looks like a navy ship. Do you think it's for us? Can't imagine who else it would be for.
Adi and Eliska spin endless scenarios of where the ship might take them. Would it deliver them to Rio, the arrival destination stamped on their Alcina tickets, beside a date of early February, 6 months past? Or was the ship simply a means to deliver them to a larger passenger vessel, bound for Europe? If it were the latter, would they be returned to Marseille, or dropped somewhere else? Would they be able to apply for new visas? And if they did, were there still passenger ships allowed to sail across the Atlantic from Europe? At noon, the Alcina detainees are called to the cafeteria, and Adi and Eliska's questions are finally answered.
"Today is your lucky day," an officer in white announces, although it's hard to know from his tone whether or not he's joking.
Hagenauer translates.
"President Vargas," the officer continues, "has granted you permission to extend your visas."
The refugees exhale collectively. Someone whoops.
"Pack your belongings," the officer orders. "You leave in an hour."
Adi grins. He wraps his arms around Eliska, lifts her from her feet.
"Of course, just to be clear," the officer adds, holding up a palm as if to dampen whatever kind of revelry was about to unfold. "The president can, at any time, and for any reason, revoke the privilege."
There is always a clause, Madame Lovebeer hisses. But the refugees don't care. They've been allowed to stay. The cafeteria is filled with the